Welcome to the Error Bar, where neural inaccuracy is indicated.
In this episode, Dr. Peter Lush from Sussex and Dr. Regina Zopp from Sydney discuss a recent controversy about rubber hands, bodily illusions, and hypnotic suggestion. Welcome to the Error Bar. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, I'm Pete Lush. I'm a postdoc at the University of Sussex.
Great. Welcome. It's great to have you here. Can I get you a drink?
Cup of tea.
Cup of tea. Perfect.
And a biscuit.
Biscuit for sure. So what brings you to the Error Bar?
You invited me.
It's a good point. So I've overheard some lively discussions in the bar about the rubber hand illusion. Maybe you can tell me a bit more about what that is.
Yeah, sure. So the rubber hand illusion is an effect that was first written about 20 years ago now. You're sitting at a desk. There's a box in front of you that you put your hand inside so that you can't see it. You put your right hand inside there. There is a fake hand, a rubber hand. It would be placed away from where your hand is. You can't see your own hand. You can see a fake hand. The experimenter then takes two brushes and begins to stroke the fingers of your hand and the rubber hand at the same time. This is usually referred to as a synchronous condition. So what you're seeing on the rubber hand is matching what you're feeling on your own hand. This is talked of as a multi-sensory illusion, and by multi-sensory it just means that there's two signals going on. You've got vision, you can see the rubber hand, and you've got this tactile, this sense of touch, you can feel the stroking of the brush on the other hand. After this procedure, people will then report an experience of touch felt on the rubber hand rather than on their own hand, and an experience of ownership of the rubber hand. That's your basic setup. There is a control condition where the brush strokes happen at different times. This is usually called the asynchronous condition. If it's going to be about this experience of ownership and touch transferred or referred to the fake hand, we need to ask people what they're experiencing. And the way that's typically done is to give a set of statements that describe experience of the illusion. For the referral of touch, this would be something like, I felt the touch of the paintbrush on the rubber hand. And for the ownership, this would be this, I felt as though the rubber hand were my own hand. There are other measures. The most popular of those is proprioceptive drift, a measure of where participants perceive their own hidden hand to be before and after the rubber hand stroking. We might typically set up a ruler in front of you and ask you to point or to say where on this ruler you felt that your hand was positioned before they start doing the rubber hand illusion procedure. And then afterwards, they ask you again. And you'd see typically a shift in the direction of the rubber hand, the shift in the reported perception of the position of your own hand towards that of the rubber hand.
And do different scientists agree on the best measurement of all these, or is there something that trumps the others?
I think it ultimately comes down to, if we're going to be measuring experience, everyone accepts that it has to be tied to report at some stage, the report of where you feel like your hand is. All this has built into a huge body of literature, which claims to show us, I think it's been very, very popular, and I think this is because there's this idea that the experience of body ownership of our body is so fundamental. The idea that it can be disrupted in this way, just through very simple multi-sensory stimulus for a very brief period of time, is really surprising. Because it seems to tell us a lot about how our experience of body ownership comes about.
It's exciting because it's an illusion and it's like you're gaining another body part or swapping someone else's body with yours.
Yeah, but I think that the key thing is that it's really exciting because it's really surprising, right? It seems like it might be somewhat maladaptive to be that easily mistaken about whether that's your body or not.
Because you can fall asleep on your hand and wake up and your hand's gone numb, you've had a temporary anesthesia and it feels rubbery and dead and kind of feels like you've lost your hand a little bit. Gaining another hand is stranger.
Yeah, or if you imagine a situation, if you imagine a sort of real-life situation, you sort of, you know, we're at a bar or something. The person standing next to you at the bar, their hand happens to be touched in the same way as yours at the time when you were standing there. You don't, I mean, maybe people do. This is, you know, it's an interesting question. Do people think, hang on, is that my hand or is that my hand?
And do you feel there are a hand illusion? Have you had it?
No. To be honest, I'm not sure what the ownership question really means. I'm not quite sure how to interpret it. So I don't know if I experienced that. The referred touch, the feeling of touch on the hand, that doesn't happen to me spontaneously, but I feel that with a sort of effort of imagination, I can imagine as though the touch was on the rubber hand. I think I get some insight into the experience then, perhaps.
I remember back in my PhD a long time ago, I remember feeling it and then not feeling it later on. And I've tried many times to get back in there in the illusion, and it doesn't really work for me. So yeah, what is it that explains different people's susceptibility?
To segue into another area of psychological research, and this is the history of imaginative suggestion. It's been primarily studied within the context of hypnosis. The way that hypnosis is usually measured in the laboratory is through scales, the standardized hypnotizability scales. These would typically be preceded by a hypnotic induction, which can take virtually any form. Usually in these scales, it will be some sort of relaxation procedure, counting down and being told that you're in a state of hypnosis. But a hypnotic induction can also be riding on an exercise bike, as long as you've been told that it's hypnosis. It can just be, now you are hypnotized. It can be anything, pretty much, as long as it establishes that this situation is a hypnotic situation and things are going to happen. In other words, people's expectancies, what they're expecting to happen, is kind of primed for something to take place.
So people come to the experiment being more or less suggestible, more or less hypnotizable. They're sitting down at a table with a rubber hand in front of them. So they have expectations about what they're going to feel, is that right?
Yes, and the important point is that they will vary in their ability to meet those expectancies by generating some experience, by imagining something, but probably not being aware that they are, that that is what they're doing. It means that every time you run an experiment, you don't know whether they're the sort of person that reports nothing for all these imaginative suggestions. They don't experience any paralysis, they don't hear any mosquitoes, nothing. Or whether they're somebody who gets all of it and they're completely blown away by it and it's like a life-changing experience for them. It's just sort of, wow, this was the most amazing. And I should say as well that there's a lot of evidence that there are changes of experience in imaginative suggestion. A hypnotic suggestion for analgesia, for example, is people will repeatedly choose that over other forms of anesthesia for dental surgery. If there's not any experience involved, it seems it would be quite a commitment to pleasing the experimenter or pleasing the dentist. You'd have to, you know, gritting your teeth, going, I'm going to pretend this is working. So I think probably here's a good place to talk about the concept of demand characteristics. This is a term that was introduced about 60 years ago by Martin Orr, who was a hypnosis researcher. It grew out of hypnosis research. He defined it as any aspect of the experimental situation or any pre-existing beliefs of participants that could affect expectancies, affect expectations in an experimental situation. He pointed out, or he argued, that when you're studying humans, if you're running an experiment with humans and they turn up, we're not just blank slates. We don't just sit there absorbing, you know, or just performing the tasks that we've been instructed to do. We kind of help ourselves. We're constantly trying to work out what's going on. It's an effort to stop yourself guessing what it is that you're supposed to be doing. Bourne argued that, therefore, that what people expect in an experiment can bias the responses. Some people might want to try and be a good participant and give the experimenter what they believe the experimenter wants. That is the key point that we're making when we talk about the rubber hand illusion and when we talk about a range of other effects that we've been looking at as well. And this is that what you expect in an experimental situation may lead to the generation of experience by the same mechanisms as people respond to imaginative suggestion. So you expect a particular experience, you generate that experience. If you take a situation like the rubber hand illusion, some people they really seem to have had an experience. They're really wowed by it. It doesn't seem like they're putting it on. They're going, whoa, that was amazing. But if you have run imaginative suggestion screenings, you get the same kind of responses. You get, there'll be some people who are just really blown away. Wow, that was amazing. How did you do that? I can really, you know, it's like there was a mosquito walking on me. I couldn't move my arm. If we return to the demand characteristics idea, we can think about what people might expect in the rubber hand illusion. You sat there, you've got a rubber hand there, you've got your own hand. The experimenter starts to stroke your hand at the same time. What is that experimenter expecting to happen? People are going to be trying to work that out. If people can work out that they're expected to feel the touch over there on the fake hand, and if they can work out that they're supposed to feel like that hand is their own hand, then this could act as like an implicit imaginative suggestion. Hypnosis grew out of mesmerism. It developed from mesmerism, sort of 18th century suggestion effect, which was attributed to the manipulation of magnetic fluid in the air. At the time, that was plausible enough scientifically. 100 years later, it wasn't so plausible, and that's when hypnosis came along. In mesmerism, typically there would be a sort of something like waving hands over the body or iron rods over the body. Mesmer used iron rods at first. These were supposed to be, you know, they manipulated magnetic fluid, and then he fell out with his iron rod maker, and then he discovered he could do it with his hands. Waving hands over somebody, you don't tell them what they're going to experience. Instead, they just respond in some way. And they would, people would have convulsions, or they'd be cured of things, or, you know, just a huge range of, there's a wide range, anything they can come up with, really, from that situation.
So if I understand, your research that you've recently done shows that people are, they come into a rubber hand illusion experiment, and how suggestible or hypnotizable they are can explain why they respond the way they do in the rubber hand illusion. Is that correct?
Well, the degree to which somebody reports experience on a hypnosis scale predicts the degree to which they will report experience of the rubber hand illusion, given this particular context. And I'd say also, I point out that the scientific context has quite a lot in common with the hypnotic context. I mean, the scientists wouldn't have got you in there unless they expected something to happen. It's this sort of authority figure, scientist, taking the place of the hypnosis. Your expectancies are raised. What's important in this situation is the controls for domain characteristics. That is, the controls for what people expect. The control for domain characteristics in rubber hand illusion studies chiefly is this asynchronous stroking condition that we discussed earlier. So the key assumption there for this to be used as a control is that people expect experience similarly for synchronous and asynchronous conditions. I think if you just introspect about that for a moment, imagine yourself receiving these two conditions. Would you expect the same experience in both? I wouldn't, but I tested it. Just use a very simple procedure. This is based on ideas of Martin Orne's again from the 60s. Just basically describe the procedure to people. They didn't take part in a rubber hand illusion. I showed them a video that showed the procedure. Didn't say it was anything to do with illusions or rubber hands, etc. Described the synchronous and asynchronous conditions and showed the synchronous and asynchronous conditions. And then just gave them the questionnaire, the standard questionnaire from rubber hand illusion, but for what they would expect to experience if they were a participant in that experiment, rather than what they did experience. And we find that what they expect in the synchronous condition and what they expect in the asynchronous condition differs. That is, they expect the experience for synchronous stroking, they don't expect it for the asynchronous condition. People, on average, know that they are supposed to experience something in the synchronous condition, not the asynchronous condition. Which means that there's the possibility that the rubber hand illusion, these reports and these objective measures are compliance bias. This is the key step we take. People responding to their ability to meet their expectancies for experience.
And after 22 years of rubber hand experiments and hundreds of papers reported, and that message kind of been very welcome. How has the field taken these results?
It hasn't gone down well. There's complete disbelief. The thing that struck me the most is the lack of interest in the demand characteristics control issue. Nobody's argued with me about that, about why that could be a valid measure for demand characteristics. So I find that quite strange and surprising, but I don't know, maybe I shouldn't be surprised, and this is just how these things go. You can't expect people to open their arms to something like that. For me, I focus on, I've got an alternative theory. We've got evidence consistent with that theory, and we've got evidence that the existing theory isn't as solid as was thought. To me, that's just normal science. If I'm wrong, then it will strengthen the rubber hand illusion because stronger valid controls will be developed. I don't think that in the long term, there's nothing to lose from it. But I gave the impression that people feel that they're losing something. But I don't see it in that way, because I think that every time we discard a particular hypothesis or find some new evidence, I mean, that's science. If you go into science, you know there's going to be change, disagreement, alternative theories.
In your ideal world, what would the best control look like?
The first thing is the way that it's been done with the synchronous and asynchronous conditions, trying to show that the score is higher in the one than the other, that's fine, we can retain that. But it's just that they need to be matched in expectancies. You need to make sure that people expect experience in the control condition to the same degree as they do in the illusion condition.
You just have that week-long experiment and it's generated, like, it's changed your life. You're now the rubber hand guy.
I really didn't intend to be the rubber hand guy, and I'm gonna do my utmost to not be the rubber hand guy. I mean, I'm doing it with other things one after another, so I'll probably just be the guy everybody hates.
So yeah, are there any regrets you have about the whole thing?
I think I would have jumped to the end point more quickly. I think that the response, I think I thought that when I raised it in the first place, people would go, oh wow, that's a concern, and start thinking we should have a go at sorting out these control methods. And that isn't what happened. I just had absolute opposition, really. Actually, that's mostly from the scientists, from the philosophers that work in or are peripheral to the rubber hand illusion, who use it in their arguments. There's been a lot more acceptance and even support. Maybe that's because, I don't know, philosophers are more used to sort of contentious argument in that way, that they're kind of, that's a philosopher's job basically, is to come along and say, I've got a different take on this, disagree with you. Having more of that in science would be helpful. It would not getting so sort of attached, maybe, not be personally invested in your data as much as possible, be aware that you're going to be fooling yourself and always be trying to. I mean, I'm going to be making the same mistakes, and someone will come along and, you know, if this thing manages to stand up for 10 years, then someone will probably tear it apart in 10 years, and then I'll be angry at them. But I'd like to think that I'll be able to, I'll try to, I would certainly be trying to think, all right, well, what did you expect?
One service we can offer you here at the Error Bar is you can confess a sin and you'll be a science sin and you'll be forgiven. Is there anything you want to own up to?
Yeah, I think that doing this has really kind of opened my eyes to domain characteristics. And now I'm seeing them everywhere. And it feels like there's this situation in psychology where, to me, it feels a bit like if, you know, after Fleming and penicillin, we realized from that you could contaminate your Petri dishes if you didn't wash them. Like 10 years later, 20 years later, everyone would just stop washing their Petri dishes again. It feels a little bit like it's a sort of hiding in plain sight. And now when I read papers, I think I've just seen domain characteristics all over the place. And that, of course, also applies to my own earlier work. Maybe I should say that again in a way that will actually not take 5 minutes.
You could give it a go. Just a snappy one-liner.
You're going to start there with the edit tool. I would say, looking back at my own earlier work, now that I've been looking at domain characteristics, I'm starting to see them in other places. I'm seeing them, you know, you become aware of this thing of like, well, thinking, what were the participants expecting? Is there any way this could be domain characteristics? And when I look at some of my early studies, well, yes, there is. And I'm testing that at the moment. And if, you know, I hope not to be publishing a paper in a short while saying, yeah, my studies were domain characteristics, but, you know, we'll see.
Welcome to the Error Bar. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, hello. My name is Regina Zopf, and I'm currently in Sydney, Australia. And I study body perception, so how we perceive our own body, and I study that in healthy participants, but also in disorders like the eating disorders. And for that, I'm particularly interested how different signals of the body sort of are combined and integrated and how that influences our body perception. And then also how we use these signals to then interact with the world around us.
Would you like a drink?
Yeah, sure.
What can I get you? What would you like?
I might have some red wine, maybe a Merlot.
Excellent choice. It's great to have you here. Our last customer was Dr. Peter Lush, who's written recently a very controversial article about the rubber hand illusion. So can you tell me how you heard about this paper and what your thoughts of that controversy are?
Yeah, no, I must say initially I found them actually quite interesting. I sort of thought, oh, there's some interesting like new data and also some interesting criticism and findings that I think are interesting for the rubber hand illusion researcher.
One thing I've seen on Twitter is that people have been quite upset by this controversy, or they've got quite angry about it. Did those emotions not cross your mind?
Yes, I guess what crossed me was more that sort of this strong claim that they, based on this data, that the illusion, that the rubber hand illusion can be explained by suggestibility. I sort of can distinguish between sort of a weak version of the data, that there's something maybe not quite right with the methods and that there's the response bias that they can influence our methods. And then the sort of strong version that the whole rubber hand illusion can be explained by suggestibility, which is more this idea that this implicit suggestion can control what we actually experience in the illusion. And I think it's that second sort of idea that I think has been pushed quite a bit by the authors and also, I guess, the media and maybe on Twitter. And that's more what I have sort of a problem, but I don't agree with that. And I don't find that they actually have strong evidence for that. I'm not convinced.
Peter was very honest, I think, and very reflective about the whole process. And I think probably he maybe regrets a little bit the arguments. And I too found it quite strongly worded. But his argument, I think, is that there's this confound that when you put people in these strange situations and you stick a rubber hand in front of them, they naturally have some expectations about what the experimenter is looking for. He found people would systematically say, yeah, the synchronous stroking is going to give me a stronger illusion than the asynchronous. How could you deal with that, do you think?
Well, I think there are other ways to measure as well, that use measurements that are not as prone to these sort of expectations or possible response biases, that people can guess what the experimenter wants you to do, and which might even underlie these correlations that they then found in the second study. And we always knew that, I mean, it's not a new thing that we think that these subjective experiences that we sort of measure using these questionnaires could be biased by expectations and bias. And so I think one way is to use measures that are maybe not so prone and not so subjective. And there are quite a few as well.
So his claims actually, I think they go even further than just about the what you might call the subjective questionnaire. In fact, they're also claiming that the proprioceptive drift and the skin conductance and maybe even other measures are also confounded by these expectations. Do you think that's a fair conclusion from his data?
Like, I have two parts to this, two answers. So maybe first I'll talk about why I don't really believe that there's strong evidence for the suggestibility idea. Although I'm intrigued by it as well, and especially when you think about the rubber hand illusion, you put this hand there and then you also have this stroking and it's sort of quite rhythmic. And I also think maybe there is something hypnotic about this. It's often dark and things like that. I don't quite, like, based on the data, I'm not convinced. We know that there's a lot of individual differences, right? So we have often 80% who get the illusion and 20% who don't get the illusion. So I think this is very intriguing. So we really don't know why some people don't get the illusion. But Lush et al. Found is some interesting like correlation that this sort of in a synchronous condition, the measures, sort of the subjective measures and also the drift correlates with this suggestibility or hypnotizability.
Like, my second point is that these correlations can also be kind of explained by two types. Like, first, it can be this response bias, or it can be explained by these implicit suggestions, and then they control sort of the phenomenology to kind of respond to these expectations. So kind of these strong claim that something that happens in the rubber hand illusion by suggestions just changes the experience. Doesn't have to be the case. Theoretically, I think what I also have missed in this whole discussion is I kind of think if they want to make this strong claim that what you change in the rubber hand illusion is you make these, you have these implicit suggestions, and then it changes the phenomenology. And there's no, it has nothing to do with kind of multisensory processes or something like that. But it's purely a cognitive top-down effect. And I really believe that they also need to develop a stronger theory. And I think this theory also has to then explain some other previously established and well-established rubber hand illusion effect. And I'm not quite sure if they can. And I give you an example. So, for example, in the rubber hand illusion, we know some factors have a strong effect and some don't. For example, when I see a hand, then I can experience the rubber hand illusion. But if it's just a block of wood, it's not possible to induce ownership or embodiment for that block of wood. It has to be kind of a hand, or hand form is really important, that it's sort of body-like. But other factors are really not so important for the illusion, like especially the skin tone or the details of the hands. But let's take the example of skin tone. Here we have basically the idea, or we know that somebody who has maybe dark skin tone can experience the illusion for a light skin tone and the other way around. And that's, for example, a finding that I don't really think this sort of suggestibility theory can explain, because in theory, when I see a hand that has a different skin tone to mine, I would really expect that this is not my hand. But at the same time, when we induce the rubber hand illusion, it doesn't seem to make a difference. For me, this is something that really can't be explained by this suggestibility idea. But we, at the same time, we have a lot of these multisensory theories or multisensory theories on the rubber hand illusion that are based on multisensory processes. And they often are very much based on sort of how we perceive something in time and space, sort of binds signals from multiple senses together. So if you feel something at the same time, as we see it, this seems to be a signal that these things belong together. Or if we experience it in the same space, two different signals, then we also combine them together. And sort of these signals that are important for multisensory binding are really sort of important for the rubber hand illusion, whereas signals that are maybe like skin tone is a purely visual one. We can't feel skin tone, so they don't seem to be important. So that really fits nicely with these multisensory ideas. And I think a challenge is then for this other theory to really explain it.
Do you experience the rubber hand illusion?
Yes, quite strongly. Yes.
Because I asked Peter Lush as well, and he said no. I also don't really feel it anymore. I used to once upon a time, but I think I explained it away to myself. Do you think researchers are drawn into studying the rubber hand illusion in particular ways, depending on how they feel the illusion?
Well, that's an interesting question. I never thought about it. Maybe it can influence it, but I don't know. Yeah, maybe. I don't know. We just have an N of one and one.
True. Yeah.
But
there might be a study there.
We need a meta study of the of rubber hand illusion researchers. So one issue that has come up in discussions with Peter and in my reading of the literature is that there isn't really a consensus on what exactly is the illusion. And this is really important for Lush's criticism, that do you just look at the questionnaire responses for the synchronous condition? Do you look at the difference between those responses? Do the responses have to be overall positive for each subject or positive for the group? Or can the illusion be measured by some of these other implicit measures? So it seems that there's no real agreement between anyone on what the illusion is exactly.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think it's can be very messy, or has been very messy, or it seems very messy. But I think one of the sort of reasons for this is I think that the illusion itself is so complex, or body perception is so complex. So when we have the illusion, it's sort of, it's not just that we experience ownership for the rubber hand, but we also feel embodied in this rubber hand. We feel like the rubber hand is in that location, that the touch we feel is coming from the rubber hand being touched. And we also have a bit this feeling that we can control the rubber hand. It's very complex, and there are a lot of different aspects. So it's really has these multiple components. And like Matthew Longo has and his colleagues, they have investigated a long time ago and studied these different components. And like ownership, location, and agency all seem to play a role in the rubber hand illusion and in this embodiment feeling. And I think that's sort of one answer why it is so confusing. What is the illusion? And because it really has all these aspects. In addition to these sort of subjective measures, we also have these other measures where we can observe behavior of people in the rubber hand illusion, like how somebody reaches or how somebody responds to touches or how somebody protects their hand. Or so there are all these different aspects as well of the body protection and action and multisensory perception. And I think all of this can really be, is really part of the illusion. And I think if one like decides on a measure, it's really important that one kind of thinks about what the question is and what measure and what aspects one is interested in. Is it like the complexity of the illusion or is it just a subset? Yeah, so I think it always will depend on the question, what measure is best. And with each measure, we should really carefully think about what potential problems is and how good this measure is. As long as one is clear why one does that, I think it seems okay from, like, in my opinion.
Do you think all these complexities can be resolved?
I think we just have to think more about the complexity and measure it more and try and get the best measurement we can get and try and then tease it apart and think more about it.
So overall, do you think on current data we can explain away the rubber hand illusion, or is there work that you think needs to be done?
Yes, definitely. I don't think we can explain it away. And I mean, the illusion still exists in both theories, but I don't think we can explain away these multisensory effects and multisensory interactions that seem to be quite important.
You mentioned it before. Did you see much of the discussion on social media or more interestingly, media reports of the rubber hand illusion of this paper? And if you did that change your view of the science or do you just sort of ignore the media?
I think this was really funny. I had a lot of people sending me the media reports and a lot of colleagues sending me, oh, what do you think about this? And it's at the end of the rubber hand illusion. And I sort of had to explain what's sort of happening. So there was a lot of, I felt like it came up all the time somehow last year, and also in a lot of discussions I had, it somehow came up. And also, yeah, on Twitter, I saw it, and I don't really think it changed because I think I read it before. I don't think I really changed my view on it.
Are you able to sort of step back from all of the complexity and the arguments and the media reports and think, what have we learned from Lush and colleagues' new study? It's not just one study, it's like four or five now. They're coming out with more. So, yeah, what have we learned from all of this?
Yeah, I think for me, the most important thing is that our methods, like especially the subjective measurements, can be influenced by expectations and then response bias. But I think that was, to me at least, clear before. I don't think that was really a new point, but I think it just highlights it again. And I think it's an important, something important to take away, and it should influence us and maybe should try and maybe think about the questionnaires a bit more that we're using and develop maybe better control questions if that's possible, or try and, yeah, kind of discuss how we can improve what we're doing there. The sort of theoretical work, I think, like we discussed, I think that needs more work for me. I'm not convinced. And at the same time, maybe it's important that people in the field who worked on the rubber hand illusion maybe pitch different theories against each other. And that's, I mean, maybe will be interesting to kind of improve theories and how we talk about them. And maybe, yeah, we can improve each other's models that way as well.
And will you still be using the rubber hand illusion in your research?
Yes, I will be. I think there are still some open questions. And I mean, I don't have any direct plans at this moment, I'll be honest. But down the track, I think if something interesting comes up, I think it's a really great tool. Because I'm interested in different signals and multisensory perception for the body, I think it's a great tool to introduce different conflicts in space and in time. And I think it's very, very useful to get to questions about the body, because it really allows us to manipulate something we weren't able to manipulate before, the rubber hand illusion.
So here at the Error Bar, we can absolve you of any sins that you've made, any scientific sins. Would you like to confess?
Yes. we talked a bit about the complexity of the rubber hand illusion and the different questions that we can use to measure the rubber hand illusion. And I must say that early in my career, I actually Because yeah, when we analyze them, we can look at different components, we can look at individual questions, or we could, for example, also just calculate a mean score across all the questions. And one thing I did is that probably when I had my questionnaires of my participants, that I actually played around a bit and explored what might be a good way to analyze the data and maybe tried out different options, which I don't think I would do anymore like that. Then later, became much more aware of the problem that this might create in terms of bias. And I have privileged a lot of my data or my analysis since, and that's probably a sin of the past, hope for me,
that I'm not really proud of looking back.
You've reformed.
Yeah, just experiencing a pre-registration process sort of really showed me how important it is.
Well, the guests have gone, so what have we learnt? Unlike most of the error bars stories, I'm actually an expert in this one. Here are three problems for embodiment, three for expectancy, and three for both. Three problems for embodiment. First, not everyone feels the rubber hand illusion. Are those who don't feel the illusion somehow not embodied? Do they not combine multi-sensory bodily information like those who do experience the illusion? Why not? Multisensory integration and just having a body seem to require that everyone experiences the illusion. Second, there's much confusion. Different questionnaires and measures give different answers to very basic questions about the illusion. After 22 years, why is there still no consensus on methods or what even exactly the illusion is? Without agreement on what it is, how can it be criticized or defended? Third, control conditions are confounded by expectancies. The new data show emphatically that participants expect different things to happen in the control and experimental conditions. So-called demand characteristics have not been dealt with. Three problems for expectancy. First, the data are far from definitive. While certainly impressive, the new data do not amount to a viable alternative account to existing multisensory explanations. Expectancy and suggestion may well explain some of the reported experiences, but I expected the gun pointing at the rubber hand illusion's head to look much more, well, gunny. Second, the idea of demand characteristics does a lot of work in the new account, but are they reliable? The idea that people will try to be good participants and behave how the experimenter wants is key, but the evidence for this actually happening in psychological experiments is not clear. Martin Orne's original paper in 1962 was not well received, follow-up studies failed to replicate, and reviews in the 1970s criticized the lack of evidence and poor experimental design. In 1976, Thomas Barber wrote that participants' concern with how they will be judged is far more important than their concern about fulfilling the experimenter's hypothesis. We need actual evidence that demand characteristics and expectancies drive people's behavior in the rubber hand illusion. Third, there's a lot of data to explain. Even if demand characteristics do drive expectancy, experience, and report in the illusion, there's 22 years of evidence still needing explaining. We just don't know if these hundreds of published effects are confounded. Three problems for both sides. First, overstating claims. The good thing about some of these strong, specific claims in the papers published by both sides is that they are very easy to fact-check. Claims that I checked up on for this discussion were quickly contradicted by single pieces of evidence. Only a full, unbiased review of the literature will help us make progress. Second, there is no such systematic review. The rubber hand illusion literature is enormously rich. I'd bet that enough data already exists out there to resolve many of the disagreements posed by this controversy, but neither side has provided an unbiased or systematic review. Third, what if history was reversed? This is a hypnotic context. The year is 2021. The expectancy theory of the rubber hand illusion has been dominant since 1998. Along come researchers taking a new measure of multisensory integration. They find that this new measure explains a large part of people's reports during the classic rubber expectancy illusion. Are you feeling comfortable? You shouldn't. If the situation had been reversed for the last 22 years, could we still be having pretty much the same argument today? I think perhaps we could. Thank you to Dr. Lush and Dr. Sopp for their fascinating discussions on the rubber hand delusion. More information and links are on the website. A full 100-minute version of our conversations will be published next week for all the rubber hand nerds out there. Subscribe via a podcast app to receive it. It's closing time at the Error Bar, but do drop in next time for more brain news, fact-checking, and neuro opinions. Take care. The Error Bar was devised and produced by Dr. Nick Holmes from the University of Nottingham. The music by D. Yang Key is available from the Free Music Archive. Find us at theerrorbar.com, on Twitter @barerror, or email talk@theerrorbar.com.